My name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the Barsmith Library at the University of Adelaide, and I welcome you all to this event this evening. I especially like to welcome our speaker tonight, Bill Gammage, who was one of the first people who welcomed me to the university when I took up my position in 1990. He and a delegation of fellow historians took me to lunch and told me the truth about life. And I think ever since then, I've probably been a little bit more partial to the historians than perhaps I should have been. But it was a very nice welcome to the university, and I thank you for that. And I'm very pleased that you're here this evening. Now, if any of you have one of these contraptions, which is called a mobile phone, now is the time to dig it out and put it on silent. Okay, everybody's done that. Now, I would like to ask the president of the Friends of the University of Adelaide Library, Professor Chris Burrell, if he will take over and introduce our speaker. Chris.
Thanks very much, Ray. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all here tonight. It's a very nice attendance. And especially pleased to welcome our speaker, Bill Gammage. Bill's one of Australia's leading historians. He's made major contributions to how we think of ourselves as Australians. He studied at the ANU, and then he had university appointments in New Guinea and also here at the University of Adelaide. But he's an authority on Australia's involvement in World War I and has published extensively on this and contributed to plays, to films, and really to Australia's cultural life in understanding our involvement in the First World War. But he's also had a long-standing interest in land management and the history of land management. And he returned to Canberra, to the ANU in 1998 in the Humanities Research Centre, and he's focused on Aboriginal land management. His approach spans a lot of disciplines, history and botany and anthropology. And the book that he's published from this, The Biggest Estate on Earth, which I'm sure you've seen outside, has been widely praised, and it's won a number of awards, and it's stimulated a radical new view of the history of human settlement way back in Australia and how humans and the Australian countryside can coexist. Now, I think this is a very exciting, very current growing topical area, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what Bill has to say. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Chris. I must say I'm always a bit awkward about generous introductions, and I think, Jesus, how am I ever going to live up to that? I certainly feel that now. I'm going to start with trees, which is where I started. In their responses to light and space and fire, plants record their history. Eucalypts store more history than most. Their shape shows whether they grew in the forest or in the open. Locally, their size sorts them by generation. And each generation's shape, size, and distribution announces the vegetation history of its surrounds, whether this was dense or open forest, or first one and then the other. Seeing trees, rather than merely looking at, seeing trees by generation can show dramatic changes, particularly where grass or woodland later became forest. This can flag a locality's 1788 and colonial past. Yeah, thanks very much, Paul. This tree is a swamp gum from southwest of Scottsdale in Tasmania. On the mainland, we know swamp gum as mountain ash. And most of us know mountain ash as dense forests of tall, straight trees, such as you see in Gippsland. A fire rages, the forest dies, in the rich ash, thousands of seedlings race up to get light, and a tall, straight forest returns. But this mountain ash has spread because it's always stood in the open. If mountain ash behaves, or cinder behaves, as I've just said, how could that be? A bushfire would kill it and replace it with swathes of competing seedlings, whereas without fire, this is rainforest land, as perhaps you can see in the background. Only centuries of control fire could burn back that rainforest without ever touching this fire-sensitive tree. Mountain ash is probably the most fire-sensitive of all eucalypts. That's one example of an interrupted plant cycle. Another is where eucalypts or bushes are capturing ancient grassland, and under their cover, rainforest is encroaching. You might have seen that in Tasmania or up the east coast, or you might have seen tourist publicity photos of giant eucalypts over the top of rainforest. Since that's happening, since eucalypts and bushes are capturing grass and then rainforest is moving in underneath, it follows that without fire, those places must grow rainforest. How come the rainforest wasn't there? Only determined and repeated fire could have made them grass in 1788, sometimes by mere metres at a time. Those fires are no more, so the rainforest comes back. Colonial words and paintings and survey land plans depicting land tell the same story. Many of them show 1788 grassland, which is now eucalypt forest. Why only now? Why not then? Some researchers say that bushfire converted pre-1788 forest to grass, but after a bushfire, scrub comes back more, not less, and bushfire really clears big eucalypts. I'm sure you've all seen burnt eucalypt country where the trees re-sprout and they soon recover their dominance. Only repeated fire, clearing seedling and sapling for centuries until the old trees die out, converts eucalypts to grass, and only people make fires like that. Forest regeneration is so evident now because people favoured grass in 1788. I think grass was in the centre of heads then, whereas trees is in the centre of their heads now, isn't it? Grassland carried many useful plants and most animals with most meat. It was a firebreak, it made seeing and travelling easier, and it confined forest, making forest resources more predictable. So almost always it took the best soil. Probably there was more grass then than now. And if there was an imbalance in Aboriginal plant distribution, it was a slight extension of grassland into forest or scrub. In other words, by Aboriginal standards, small encroachments by fire, marginally out of control. In short, for over 220 years, the land has been shouting at us newcomers that we've got it wrong. The country was not natural, but made. Aborigines made it by using fire or no fire to distribute plants, and plant distribution to locate animals, to position animals. Giving plants and animals ideal conditions made them abundant. Carefully distributing their habitats made them convenient and predictable. This was possible because most Australian plants tolerate fire, and because in Australia, almost uniquely, the only large predators to disturb prey that you were concentrating were people. Most of us now accept what Rhys Jones neatly called fire stick farming, that is, patch burning grass to bring on fresh growth to lure grazing animals. A few early newcomers noted this. At Albany in Western Australia, George Vancouver observed in 1791, fire is frequently resorted to by rude nations, either for the purpose of encouraging a sweeter growth of herbage in their hunting grounds, or as tools for taking the wild animals of which they're in pursuit. In northwest Tasmania, Henry Hellyer remarked in 1828, "It's possible that the natives, by burning only one set of plains, are enabled to keep the kangaroos more concentrated for their use, and I can in no way account for their burning only in this place unless it is to serve them as a hunting place. Aborigines themselves stated at Evans Bay in 1849, observing that the grass had been burnt on portions of the flats, the blacks said that the rain that was coming on would make the young grass spring up, and that would bring down the kangaroos, and the blacks would spear them from the scrub. Evans Bay is next to Torres Strait. It's as far from Albany and Tasmania as you can get in Australia, and yet all three peoples manage land similarly. Evans Bay is also next to islanders who gardened. People could compare their management with Torres Strait agriculture, but if they did try gardening, which is possible given the presence of exotic plant species on Cape York, but if they did try it, they gave it up, they abandoned it. Instead, they matched the rest of the continent, choosing a course they thought more efficient and reliable. In 1845, Ludwig Leichhardt called this choice a systematic management of their country. A choice made large-scale gardening impossible because people allied with fire. About 70% of Australia's plant species tolerate or encourage fire, and that's a key fact about Australian vegetation. Trees and bushes reseed or resprout, while dominant fodder grasses are perennial, and so unlike Europe's fodder annuals, they reshoot. In other words, they refuel. 1788's first fire task was to control fuel by ceremony, naturally, and by constant, careful burning. This let people prevent the terrible killer fires which have immolated the fringes of every Australian capital except Darwin in recent decades. Fires which must have decimated people in 1788 had they occurred. They simply couldn't have outrun them. But regular fires prevented irregular fires. Instead of the slogan of my youth, prevent bushfires, which was nailed up on every big tree, the rule in 1788 was a fire a day keeps bushfires away. Taming fire was a great achievement. It's one we haven't managed, isn't it? It was also cause to manage every corner of the continent. There was no wilderness, no terra nullius in 1788. Edward Eyre observed in 1841, no part of the country is so utterly worthless as not to have attractions sufficient occasionally to tempt the wandering savage into its recesses. The very regions which, in the eyes of the European, are most barren and worthless, are to the native the most valuable and productive. So to every place the fire stick came. Of course, people burnt the most useful land most, and sterile or sensitive land perhaps not for generations, but sooner or later they burnt everywhere. Quote, in every part of the country, though the most inaccessible and rocky, John White observed in April 1788. On the highest mountains and in places the most remote and desolate, in every place, Thomas Mitchell wrote in November 1836. So if fuel built up, it was burnt. And that unleashed rich possibilities. And I'll outline now some stages from controlling fuel up to managing species. Firstly, the more fuel is reduced, the more easily is fire controlled, and so the more useful it is. Two, even hot fires leave unburnt patches, but the cooler the fire, the bigger the patches as a general rule. Three, those patches benefit animals by joining burnt, that's feed, to unburnt, that's shelter country. Four, patches form mosaics, which can be adjusted in size by varying fire intensity. Five, intensity can be regulated by fire frequency and fire timing. Six, frequency and timing are local, are necessarily local. They depend on local flora and local moderators like rain and wind and temperature and aspect and so on. Seven, the better that people understand these variables, the more they can burn with purpose. They can move just from limiting fuel to shaping the country. And 8, this lets them selectively locate fire-tolerant and fire-sensitive plants, situate mosaics and resources conveniently and predictably, and arrange them so that one supplies what another doesn't. Local variations in managing fire are many and obvious. You can never burn rainforest in the same way as Spinifex, and in the north you could rarely burn during the wet, whereas the south, there are opportunities year round. You could burn today, for example, even though it's in the middle of winter. But everywhere, the basic purposes of fire were the same. That is, to limit fuel, to ensure diversity and abundance, to regulate plant and animal populations. The plant patterns that people made with fire were the same too. Grass on good soil, forest split by grass, tree and scrub clumps in grassland, undergrowth uncommon. And the benefits were the same. Plants and animals were located predictably and conveniently. So carefully was fire managed and so great its impact that we might easily miss its obvious corollary, which is no fire. A conscious decision not to burn also regulates plants and animals. People judged equally what to burn and what not, when, how often, and how hot. So fire and no fire work together. This is not simply fire stick farming. To my dismay, some readers think my book merely elaborates fire stick farming. I think they meant it as a compliment. But they mistake my case and they diminish the beauty and complexity of what people were doing in 1788. Fire stick farming, when you think about it, is an end point. It's a harvesting. It activates grass or reed patches, but it does it on land made ready long before by very different fire regimes. Proof of its limits lies in how much 1788 fire did not suit it. For example, people made some grassland to keep animals off, and so they never patch burned it for fresh growth. Yam daisy, which is a tuber and a staple, grows amid the same rich grass which best lures grazing animals, and kangaroos love it, yet it flourished in millions in 1788. Fire also thinned or distributed forest or scrub which might never be patch burnt, while along forest edges people might let grass grow and dry and then in the right wind fire it hot to drive prey to waiting hunters. This is the cover of the book. It's Joseph Lycett, Aborigines Using Fire to Hunt Kangaroos, painted about 1820. And you can see here the dense forest rises up from a lower ground between grassy hills. There's a very sharp edge, an unnaturally sharp edge, I think it's safe to say, between the forest and the grass. People have fired the edge, the grass edge in the forest, to drive prey to waiting hunters. You can see a kangaroo at a great disadvantage being forced to go uphill, a grey kangaroo probably, into the arms of waiting huntsmen. In other words, people are not chancing on game. They're not wandering around in the off chance of finding a kangaroo. They know where it's going to go and they're waiting to harvest it, basically. They're also protecting the forest. They're firing its lee edge so that the wind takes the flames into the grass. If the wind lay the other way, then they could fire at the other edge and achieve the same result. So skillful burning keeps the forest dense, the grass clear, and the game convenient and predictable. Near Brisbane, John Matthew saw the reverse technique. There, in much even denser forest, he said, hunters, quote, fire the grass in a line from one projecting point of the scrub to another and force the game away to a corner formed by the scrub margin so that the game, obliged to seek shelter in the scrub, became easy marks for the persons posted along its edge. In other words, they're using fire to drive prey into waiting hunters who are hidden. People also backburnt around clubs or single trees, clumps or single trees to protect them, and they sheet burnt to clean up country. In the centre in June 1876, Ernest Giles reported, "The few native inhabitants of these regions occasionally burn every portion of their territories, and on a favourably windy day, a spinifex fire might run on for scores of miles. We occasionally cross such desolated places where every species of vegetation has been by flames devoured." Big fires scour the centre today, carbonising the topsoil, as Peter Latz puts it. But 1788's big fires were controlled. Giles continued, "Devoured they are, but not demolished, as out of the roots and ashes of their former natures, phoenix-like, they rise again." So that burning is conscious of the behaviour of plants and fire. Fire-sensitive plant communities evidence other fire regimes, which are also not fire stick farming. Today you can see rainforest remnants in sheltered inland gorges like Palm Valley or Kings Canyon, and they seem curious anomalies. They're advertised as that, aren't they? Green oases, ring by aridity. But their survival shows that for generations, people took care to regulate how many fires, or more exactly, how few, broke into them. Early European travellers cursed dense forest. In fact, in 1788, people laced such forests with paths and clearings, but in any case, many plants and animals prefer it, so naturally Aboriginal people are going to provide it. The value of dense eucalypt forests was strikingly demonstrated in January 1798, when the first fleet emancipist and initiated man, John Wilson, led an expedition southwest through Bargo Brush and on almost to Goulburn, by the way, well ahead of that famous crossing of the Blue Mountains in 1813. Bargo Brush was soon to become notorious for its poor soil and stringy bark, which is to say the same thing really, and its tangles of scrub and fallen timber. Europeans hated it. But there, in one memorable week, the party noted the first koala, the first lyrebird, the first gangang cockatoo, and the first mainland wombat recorded by a European. The gangang was new to Wilson, but he knew the wombat and the koala, giving their Aboriginal names, wombat and kalawan, from which no doubt koala derives, if you pronounce it. He knew the lyrebird, but he called it a pheasant, which perhaps is why today it has no familiar Aboriginal name. The point is that no one in a settlement that was thirsty to discover, and a settlement where you can make a lot of money out of discovering new species and selling them to gentlemen scientists, no one had reported these creatures. Their country was bad, formidable, seeming untouched. Wilson knew them because Aborigines valued them and made or left habitats for their benefit. So it's not only grass. Where a purpose is apparent, I call plant communities deliberately associated long-term templates. Dense forest or swamp margins were as much templates as grass forest associations for fire stick farming, but no matter which plant communities dominated locally, similar templates for similar purposes recurred across Australia. From spinifex to rainforest, from Tasmania to the Kimberleys, people associated food plants and shelter plants. By selecting optimum conditions on templates and not nearby, they made target plants and animals on them abundant, convenient and predictable. They then activated the templates in planned rotation according to season and their circumstances. So they knew where their resources would be and when to harvest them. They could choose. They depended not on chance, but on policy. Now, licence painting depicts a template, and I've got two more here, from opposite edges of the continent, just to show their span. This is Eugen, or Eugene if you like, Eugen von Gerard, the crater of Mount Eccles in 1858. It's very, we've jumped one. Okay. This is James J. Cobbin, the survey plan of Cowie Point on Cape York in 1891. In this, green stands for rainforest and white is open eucalypt forest. The original survey, you can just see relics of it here, and I touched it up to make it clearer, but I haven't altered it. Cobbon had to certify on honour, quote, on honour, that his plan was accurate, and yet every vegetation type is on every terrain. Rainforest, or what he called vine scrub, screens camps along the beach from hunting grounds inland. Both tree communities are on every level of ground. You can see here on the headwaters of a creek, rainforest, but down here on the lower country where you expect rainforest to grow much more readily, it's open eucalypt forest. You can see here in the valleys, eucalypt forest, on the hills, eucalypt forest, up here, some of each. So there's no natural association between the rainforest or the eucalypt forest and the terrain. And then look at this swamp. This is a swamp here. Two sides, and obviously therefore all on the one level, two sides are rainforest and two sides are eucalypt forest. So clearly, this is a made landscape. And that made landscape led early Europeans to think it good cropland, usually for tobacco, that's what they were thinking. But without repeated fire, this land becomes dense rainforest, and that's what it is now. Check it on Google Earth and you'll see. I'll see if I can go back. Here we are. Von Gerard's crater in Mount Eccles. Now you can actually, there's a walking trail around Mount Eccles and you can actually stand pretty well where Von Gerard stood. If you've been there, this plateau now is a car park. This is a photo opportunity where these horsemen are. It says photo opportunity. And you go in through this very dense scrub, battling away and wondering if there are any ticks to get to it. You can find these rocks. You can find these rocks. I don't know about these. These trees, you can see, are all young. They've obviously grown in the last few years. Von Gerard's there in 1858, so probably in the previous 10 years, these young trees have grown up. The biggest trees then are the biggest trees now. They overhang in this country. But look at this patterning here. Grass tree, the same outside, the same up here, same in here, same over here. No one can say to me that that's a natural landscape. And in fact, all this is tree or bush covered now. What's going on is that Aboriginal people make these grass lanes for feed and the tree lanes for shelter. Then they activate that template as convenient. For example, you might light a patch of grass here, wait a fortnight until the green growth comes on, then you could ambush the feeding kangaroos on either side by coming out of the scrub. If the kangaroos go uphill, they're at a disadvantage, as we saw in Lycett's painting. If they go down, they're going to hit the water and they're even at even greater disadvantage. So in other words, this has been made a wallaby trap, basically, or at least a marsupial trap. Again, another template. Two factors blended to make templates. One of them is the ecological one, which is obvious. The other was religious. Ecologically, laying out country variably to suit and balance all other species meant undeviating commitment to very intricate land management. Just imagine burning to create that. Individual inclination and enterprise must be curbed, and ecological rules and knowledge must reach beyond living generations. The law, a religious philosophy rooted in ecology, compelled this. Across Australia, it taught that every living thing has at least one totem derived from a creator ancestor, otherwise it can't exist. Even life that Europeans introduced, rabbits and camels, houseflies, flew, they have a totem, and every totem has people who belong to it and at the risk of their souls must care for it and its habitat. So emu people must care for emus and emu habitat, and emus and emu habitat must cause care for them, because plants have a soul too, and so on. There are rules and myths and ceremonies about the sanctity of totems, including fire, which warned and instructed until the consequences of disobeying were too terrible to contemplate. Totems thus protected diversity and enforced conformity via religious sanction, the most powerful possible in any society. Evidence for an intricate fusion of law and ecology exists in Australia in enough dispersed places to say that the whole continent was a single estate. People went further. They made land beautiful. After bush, the most common word newcomers used to describe the landscape was park. It's a striking word. Europe's parks were made. They deliberately associated water and grass and trees in picturesque array. Few were public in 1788. Most were the preserve and mark of gentry. They signified wealth and leisure. Yet newcomers frequently compared Australia with them. In Port Jackson on the 26th of January 1788, Arthur Bowes Smyth rejoiced at the beautiful and novel appearance of the different coves and islands as we sailed up. The finest terraces, lawns and grottos with distinct plantations of the tallest and most stately trees I ever saw in any nobleman's grounds in England cannot excel in beauty those which nature now presented to our view. In November 1826, Robert Dawson thought the country inland from Port Stephens in New South Wales, quote, truly beautiful. It was thinly studded with single trees, as if planted for ornament. It is impossible, therefore, to pass through such a country without being perpetually reminded of a gentleman's park and grounds. The first idea is that of an inhabited and improved country combined with the pleasurable associations of a civilised society. In Tasmania, John Hudspeth praised the beautiful and rich valley of Jericho, more like a gentleman's park in England, laid out with taste than land in its natural state. W.H. Lee thought the country south of Adelaide a wild but beautiful park which reminded one of the domain of an English noble. And Alexander Buchanan considered the west side of the Murray below the Big Bend really most beautiful, like a gentleman's park all the way, fine plains and thinly studded with trees, grass up to the horse's knees. Indeed, it was like riding through a ryegrass field. Look at it now. And there are hundreds of similar remarks from all over Australia, including in the centre. But even when they saw parks, most newcomers still thought the land natural. They assumed that primitive hunter-gatherers lacked the skill and inclination to make parks. And yet, a clue was there in that observation that fire made fresh grass to lure kangaroos. You can see how that fresh grass lure works today on golf greens, where you get kangaroos who prefer to risk flying golf balls and angry greenkeepers to get at the fresh growth on the green, even though there might be safer and longer grass just a couple of metres away. So let's explore that with grey or forested kangaroos such as we saw Lycett depict. To attract them with fire, you've got to ensure that they go where you've burnt. So you must make sure the grass you burn is the sweetest and most nutritious available. You've got to take care not to burn other grass too close, and you've got to provide shelter nearby so that kangaroos won't feel vulnerable. To ensure that the grass you burn is the sweetest and most nutritious available, you've got to put it on the best soil, obviously. Trees grow on soil like that, so you must burn to keep it permanently clear of trees or most trees. Yet kangaroos shelter among trees, so you've got to provide them neither too open so the kangaroos feel exposed, nor too dense so they fear being slowed down if they have to flee. So beside the grass you must have open forest, and perhaps beyond it dense forest to shepherd the roos back towards the grass. In other words, you must make not only the grass, which is what fire stick farming is about, but also the land around, using at least three distinct fire regimes and probably more. Now, there's no point in doing all this just in one place, because after you hunt kangaroos, they move. You must lure them to the next place you've prepared, then the next, and so on. In short, you must pattern the whole country into places which will and won't shepherd grey kangaroos if you want to farm them successfully. Now think of all the other marsupials, red kangaroos, wallabies, potoroos, and so on. Of course, not all in the same area, but each with their distinctive habitat preferences. And then go on to think of all the other plants, animals, birds, reptiles, and insects which flourished when Europeans arrived. All had their place because of the totem law. All had food and shelter which suited them. Many are now gone or going. To accommodate such diversity, a great variety of templates have to be set up. Of course, some species will find a home in more than one template, possums obviously, but others don't. Spinifex and mulga, rainforest and blady grass, eucalypts and tussock grass with bulbs and tubers, mangroves, reeds and other water plants, all of that must be laid out. Given how long some trees live, this might take centuries to set up. Templates for the same purpose could be close, but when they were activated, they had to be far enough apart not to disrupt each other, as that obviously would make the target animals unpredictable and the whole system pointless. So activating a template meant negotiating with neighbours and totem elders. The law prescribed most of this, but still negotiation must have been constant so that the template system could hardly have had land boundaries. There couldn't be a place where it was practiced and next to it a place where it wasn't. You couldn't have a place where neighbours were negotiating continuously next to a place where they behaved randomly. Australia was inexorably a singular state and there was no wilderness. This system was much more than merely sustainable. Possibly even in hard times, it was so abundant. Sustainable is our word, isn't it? It always gives me the image of just keeping our noses above water, you know, just sustaining life. Whereas the Aboriginal preference was for abundance. Even in hard times, that system was so abundant that people may normally have harvested only resources that were made surplus by expanding off their templates, whether they plant or animal. Such abundance was possible because people had plenty of land, so they could let plants and animals recover undisturbed. Mobility was thus a great advantage. We have a tradition of thinking of mobility as the hallmark of barbarians, don't we? It was a great advantage. Whereas farming licensed population growth, mobility curbed it. Whereas farming drove people out of marginal land, mobility let them prosper there. People did not have to stay by their crops, and no livestock, no beast of burden anchored them. Donald Thompson noted that Arnhem Land clans spent several months mobile and several months sedentary each year, but each period was equally planned and predictable. He said a regular and orderly annual cycle carried out systematically and with a rhythm parallel to and in step with the seasonal changes. The nomadic movements of these people can be forecast with accuracy and their camps foretold with reasonable certainty. Phyllis Carberry thought mobility, abundance and predictability let Kimberley women work less hard than farmers' wives, yet get food more certainly. It is not, she said, the steady strenuous labour of the German peasant woman, she was German originally, bending from dawn to dusk over her fields, hoeing, weeding, sowing and reaping. The Aboriginal woman has greater freedom of movement and more variety. The agriculturalist may be left destitute and almost starving if the crops fail or are destroyed by drought, flood, fire, locusts or grasshoppers, as sometimes happens in China and in Europe. I never saw an Aboriginal woman come in empty-handed, though in 1935 there was a drought. She concluded women's work compares favourably with a European 8-hour day. Geoffrey Blainey pointed out that the people work many fewer hours a day to secure food and shelter than farmers anywhere. Now, perhaps neither of those authors counted fire or ritual as work, but only people untroubled about food could have held so many ceremonies. Of course, there were hungry times, or people wouldn't have managed their resources so carefully, but it was not the norm. People were not hinging on uncertainty or toil. On the contrary, they could afford to host hundreds of guests, sometimes for months. This required setting aside big stretches of country for years ahead to build up food, and yet such occasions were common. Abundant resources are also attested by how much spare time people had. Europeans often complained, and some still complain, that Aborigines were lazy, that they sat around for hours talking, dancing or singing, even in broad daylight. Today, many outsiders think that the most distinctive features of Aboriginal society relate to art or corroboree, in other words, to what Europeans think leisure. In fact, much of this is work, planning or performing to keep country and future alive, but only a well-ordered society could afford so much time away from the food quest. Really, the best parallel for Aboriginal society in 1788 is Europe's gentry, so it's not surprising that newcomers thought the land so often like a park. Those parks have gone. Stopping fire, let trees grow. Near Harndorf in midsummer 1839, Dirk Hahn saw people burning in the Onkaparinga Valley. They form a circle about 20 English miles in diameter, light fires around this area, and then direct the fire closer and closer in towards the centre of this circle. That's quite a trick. The long dry grass, bushes and young trees burn fiercely. All the animals living in this area flee towards the centre, where the savages then capture them. The fire burned for some days. I'd never before seen such a fire. In the same valley, Hahn saw the result of such fire. Beautifully formed trees, which nature had planted there as if with the hands of a gardener. Every tree stood about 40 feet apart from the others. Some were perhaps an acre apart, so that the land could be cultivated without uprooting a single tree. I found grass a metre high. They looked like our European cornfields. Here's that valley, I hope, 30 years later. This is William Rodolph Thomas, Aboriginal family group on the Onkaparinga River near Harndorf in 1870. You can see the scattered big trees that Hahn admired, like that mountain ash. They're spread, confirming that they grew in the open. But there are no cornfields now, there's only scrub. This ruin is what many think southern Australia was like when Europeans arrived. The southeast colonies passed their key coast closer settlement acts in the 1860s. So this 1870 scene conveys what the selectors faced, or the credit agreement people here. No parks, but decades of backbreaking axe work. And 100 axes, of course, are not nearly as efficient as control fire. Frederick McCubbin, Down on His Luck, 1889. I chose this not because it's a especially good illustration of the point I'm going to make, but because I want to suggest to you that you can walk into any art gallery and see in these colonial paintings evidence of Aboriginal land management. In this one, you can see where regenerating plants, she-oak, wattle, eucalypts, are recapturing grassland, which is exactly what you'd expect of southeast land released from fire. The question is, how did it get to be grass in the first place? Only one tree is older than about 1840, when newcomers occupied this district. A big stringy bark, its trunk partly blackened by fire. So we can see from that this was once woodland. Now, as it gets denser and denser with this regen, the axe is going to have to work. So the pioneer legend rightly honours the hardy men and women who carved homes from that dense bush, but it's not how most land was in 1788. Instead, it would have been all grass. So, to conclude, to locate and rest resources, the template system needed big areas free of people, while allying with fire required a mobile population with few fixed assets. A scant and scattered population made 1788 Australia vulnerable to invasion, but this should not mask how impressive the Aboriginal achievement was. To balance land and people so richly and sustainably for so long across so great an area ranks among humanity's great achievements. No other world civilization managed it. Almost all turned from hunter-gathering to agriculture, and thence in time to a bad end or an uncertain future. Aborigines never joined the agrarian world's race to a complex technology. There are instances of farming in 1788, but people were never likely to convert to it. Fire gave too many advantages. It let people fuse the ecology and religion of an entire continent into the biggest estate on earth, and instead of dividing Aborigines into gentry and peasantry, it made them a free people. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bill. That really inspires and overturns a lot of the concepts we have about the country and our place in the country. I'm sure there are questions.
Aboriginal has been here about 50,000 years. What's the effect of natural evolution of the plants versus this continuous controlled burning?
I can't say how long the system I'm describing operated. Aboriginal people clearly had plenty of incentive to learn how plants and animals behaved. If you think of the dramatic fluctuations in climate, for example, from Tasmania covered with ice and the rest of Australia pretty arid to where it was mainly covered with rainforest and pretty well everything in between, it clearly behoved them to learn about these things. But when exactly they got to the degree of perfection they had in 1788, I can't say. I'm sure they went through a learning curve. All people do, don't they? But exactly what the shape of that curve is, I couldn't say. I talk about 1788, not 50,000 years ago.
Thanks, Bill. Just one question. You were saying that they burned down south in Tassie, then up towards, you know, Darwin Way. So did they burn up in Papua New Guinea? And if not, why not? Because of the way they're going up. Do you understand the question?
Yes, a long while ago they were the one continent, weren't they? There's a lot of fire goes on in Papua New Guinea, where I lived for a few years. But it's to clear grass, sometimes to hunt Magani, to hunt wallabies, but mainly to create village gardens. There's a very interesting article written by Peter Dwyer on the effects that that has. He compared three communities in Papua New Guinea, one that was entirely farmers, one that was entirely hunter-gatherers, and one that was in between. To take the two extremes, he found that the farmers' mental boundary stopped at their fences. The fence on the ground created a fence in the mind. Beyond that was wild country. People might go in there to hunt and so on, but it wasn't civilised. For hunter-gatherers, there's no such boundary. All of it was the same. And I think that illustrates, you can see that in Papua New Guinea, it illustrates the difference between Papua New Guinea and Australia as well.
The eucalypt species, the dominance of that in Australia, theory sort of continue without the eucalypt being such an important species in the Australian landscape? Could it have occurred if we were conifers or some other palm-type concentrations of species?
I'm prejudiced in favour of eucalypts.
Well, some call them weeds, of course.
Yeah, not me. And eucalypts and fire clearly allied long before Aboriginal people were here. And that alliance was conquering Australia, perhaps from 150,000 years ago. And I guess that what happened is that Aboriginal people saw that alliance and basically joined it. If there were no eucalypts, would they have done the same thing? Well, if there are no eucalypts, then you're positing that all the other flammable plants in Australia, the hakeas and the callistemons and so on, also wouldn't exist because they evolve under similar sorts of conditions. And so you're positing a question whether there was an entirely different plant regime. I still think it's possible, and the reason I think it's possible is because you can see glimpses of the same fire management patterns in North and South America and in Southern Africa, and also if you've been watching the history of ancient Britain, you get clues of it, Neil Oliver's program, you get clues of it in prehistory Great Britain. There's a book to be written on North America. I think that the evidence is there for patterns not as extensive as in Australia because you have farmers smack in the middle of America for a long while, but something along the same lines.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed that the entire presentation. I have trouble, though, with one of the examples that you used. And I have difficulty with appreciating the efficiency of the method that Captain Hahn described. I'm not sure if you said it was 20 miles in circumference or in diameter or in radius, but a very large area being burnt at one time from the outside inwards, driving, I think your account said, all of the animals into the centre. Now, my understanding of a fire that's burning from the outside to the inside is that the burners, those lighting the fires, would be on the outside, and what they're trying to catch is, in fact, going to be caught within flames in the centre. So my two questions relating to that are, if that's the case, what would be the real success rate? And secondly, what happens tomorrow, given that you don't have methods to preserve your food, do you find another 20 mile patch to burn? Could you help me with those details, please?
He said they form a circle about 20 English miles in diameter. It is a lot, and it's an illustration, I think, of what I was saying about having plenty of land and the advantage of mobility. Clearly, to create that fire, you're going to restrain the normal fire regimes, which might make it grass and so on, in order for fuel to build up and to encourage animals into it. You know, in other words, it would seem to animals a bit like a conservation area, or in Aboriginal terms, a totem place, a special place where they were safe forever. But in fact, it wasn't. And so you've then got to find the right conditions of day and time of day and so on to light that fire. A lot of animals would have got burnt in the centre, I'm sure, but of course Hahn was certainly not going to be in the middle of the centre to see what was going on there. And some animals would try and break back through the flames, and they are presumably the ones that he observed being captured.
I wonder, Bill, could you say something about the social organisation amongst the Aborigines needed to do these sort of plans? I mean, would they need to be organised in a big number of people in a big area? And is that more than we consider they had in terms of social organisation?
Yes, you'd certainly need a lot of people, wouldn't you,
yeah,
to ring
yeah.
that country. Yeah. I think we tend to underestimate the number of Aboriginal people there were. A lot of travellers would see a family group. Family is an extended family, what we call an extended family. Man, his wife, parents, brothers, children, That's a family. They're the basic land management unit. Mm-hmm. And most land maintenance was done by them. Bigger projects are then done by clans that come together, if I can use that word. And then for really big projects like this, you'd presumably have guests and you'd have a lot of people. I mean, obviously you'd have a lot of people because in such a large area, you'd be collecting a huge amount of game. And the only reason you'd do that is if there were a lot of people to eat it. So the two of them evidence large congregations. And in fact, we have accounts of 1,000 people dancing and corroborees and so on.
Hi, I'm just wondering, like, what inspired you to do this kind of area of research? Did you go looking for this park-like grassland in your research through European history here in Australia, or did you happen upon it when you were doing research about burning?
It's very hard to see Aboriginal parks now. I don't really know of any. So the parks come from the observations of early Europeans. I came at it from the point of view of the plants by seeing anomalies between when I used to work as a weed lumper, and when I was doing that, like all farm people, you associate trees and soils because you see a tree, you know what the soil is and so on. And yet I'd find non-farming areas where there was no trees, there was grass or only very young trees. And the puzzle for me was, how did this come about? And you think, oh, it must be salt in the soil or something like that. You discount all those and you're left with Aboriginal fire. And that led me then to go further and further into it. I used to bore my friends stupid when we'd go for a walk. I'd say, look at that, why is that like that? Some people here might remember me doing that here.
That was a terrific talk. Thank you, Bill. When I was in Darwin in 1995 and driving through the bush a bit south, there were occasional patch fires, which we were told were patch fires. Now, they're Aboriginal. Now, does this mean that they had revived that, or is this tradition still continuous after all those years? And are there places where it is still a continuous tradition?
Both. There are places where it's still continuous, and around Darwin, or at least across the top end, is one of those places. And it's also traditional methods are now being reverted to, and they're expanding. For a long while, Aboriginal people in the north were constricted in how they could burn because they were burning on pastoral stations, and so they're burning for cattle. Burning for cattle is a very different thing from burning for species diversity. You know, what you're doing with cattle is creating grass, especially near water. But diversity, you have, as I say, you back burn around clumps of trees and you've got special places that you protect. And Aboriginal people were stopped from doing that. But in some places, they kept it going. I was talking to a man on a man and greeter outstation who's following what his grandfather told him. And he was talking to me about a stretch of a creek, I guess 80, 100 metres long. And he had three different fire periods, and in each of those three different fires for that 80 metres of creek. And that's clearly not cattle. That's
and
tradition.
Does this mean then that the Aboriginal methods have been used and are being used for the modern cattle industry?
Not yet. Yes, there could be, and there are some pastoral stations that have contracted with Aboriginal communities, or communities isn't a legal entity, but bodies set up by Aboriginal communities to burn for cattle, to develop carbon sequestration programs on the pastoral station and so on. I hope more of that will happen. I don't think any Aborigine knows as much as the people of 1788, but they know a lot more than us, and almost all of us. And so I hope that will develop and get as much of that 1788 expertise back as they can.
Yeah, thanks for a wonderful presentation. Marvellous insights. You talk about the burning aspect for food production, basically. Could you just elaborate on the density of the animals and the bird life that were here in this country before white people came? I was listening to a writer at Writers Week a couple of months ago talking of Flinders when he passed by Tasmania, and he was so particular about aspects of what he saw that he calculated that there were 7 million birds in a flock that flew past the boat. To our eyes, 7 million birds in one hit of one species is almost totally unbelievable. And yet this was commonplace.
Yes, it was. There are counts of, well, basically counts of seas black with fish, and the skies black with birds. The first fleet, the encounters of the first fleet, they'd go out in boats and look over the side, and then they'd see it just swarming with fish in Port Jackson. And that sort of thing is all over the country. Similar with kangaroos, although interestingly, if you look at some journals, for example, Evans, who crossed the Blue Mountains and then went onto the Liverpool Plains, and Charles Sturt, if you look carefully, what you can see they're doing is, on one day they'll say we saw a big mob of kangaroos. Then they'll go two or three days without seeing any, and another big mob. And I think, I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect that what's happening there is that Aboriginal people are concentrating big mobs of roos in some place and then actually deterring them from occupying the country in between. You couldn't stop the young bucks, but you could stop the mob as a whole by doing that.
I'm sorry, I think we'll have to finish up at this point, but Bill will be here if anyone has questions they want to ask after the formal part of the talk. Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Bill.
That's
for a most inspiring and interesting talk.
Thank you. Thank you.